Mistrial, an inside look at how the criminal justice system works and sometimes doesn't. Written by Mark Garagus and Pat Harris and narrated by Mike Dawson.
Another thing about the Scott Peterson case that has always puzzled us is the widespread, almost unanimous opinion that Scott was guilty before one piece of evidence was introduced. If you examine every high-profile case of the past two decades, O.J., Michael Jackson, Casey Anthony, Robert Blake, the Duke lacrosse team, Dr. Conrad Murray, you'll see that every one of the defendants had some group or constituency that argued on behalf of their innocence. But Scott Peterson didn't. When we took over the case, we soon found out that it was considered an accepted fact that he was guilty.
Mistrial. Available now at iTunes, Audible, and AdamCarolla.com.
Target, USA. Russia.
Could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile.
Capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Interviews with top intelligence and national security officials. We've got you covered on Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
Download it every Thursday. And don't forget to subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, and at Apple Podcast.
This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice. Big on. Man, get on. And welcome to the best hour in the universe, Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla, Mark Garagus over there.
Good to see you. It seems like it's been 2 weeks.
It's been too long.
Way
although
too long.
I cruise the neighborhood. I run into your wife periodically, who's also on foot. I think you could probably tell, you know, I have my yardsticks to sort of measure prosperity.
Right.
Now, again, I've always said this, as soon as Los Angeles started putting their first bit of concertine wire, barbed wire around the first freeway sign, they should have stopped and said, where are we going?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on?
The slippery slope.
What's happening? Here's a city. Let's gut check time. Let's find a mirror. The more women you can see walking around your neighborhood between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. on weekdays, the more affluent your neighborhood is.
Absolutely. And the more time your wife spends in Europe, I think, is directly correlated. Yeah. It's like a variation on Richard Pryor's old line about cocaine being God's way of telling you make too much money. It's your wife being in Europe all the time.
I have not experienced that because Lynette never goes to Europe and I never go to Europe. But I do cruise the neighborhood pretty religiously. And I see a lot of the wives and they're all out and they're not walking with purpose either. It's just a Thursday and it's 10:15 and they got nothing better to do and nowhere to go.
And when I leave to get to downtown, I go down to Descanso. Do you ever drive down Descanso?
Yeah.
By the lovely Descanso Gardens. And there are, I would say on any given day, there's at least 50 to 100, mostly women, a couple of old guys, but mostly women.
I will say this. That is a good sign for your community. Another very good sign is sort of too young to be retired, 51-year-old guy in really good shape, riding a 10-speed hard through the same neighborhood at the same time.
Right.
Because I run into the 10-speed guys, too, and I think to myself, it's Thursday. And what are you doing?
Why is it that...
Now, he's probably thinking to me, it's Thursday.
What are you
doing?
The
fuck are you doing? But I am not only assessing the folks that are walking through the neighborhood, but I have a job to go to later on. Not sure what the 10-speed guy is doing, but
a day trader would be my guess.
Yeah, he probably gets up at 3 a.m. because the Nikkei opens over in Asia and he's got to monitor that. And now that he's done with his work, he's a day trader, he's on his specialized. Now, here's a bad sign. Bad sign for the neighborhood.
Worse than barbed wire or
equally as bad?
Bad, okay. Telltale sign.
Guy on 10 speed,
yeah,
riding at 10:30 in the morning on a Thursday. with a second mountain bike that he's ghost riding next to him by holding the handlebars.
Ooh.
Meaning he's either stealing that bike or his friend was shot and he's taking it back to gang headquarters or whatever it is. Same guy, you know, same 10 speed, same time, same day, totally different motivation.
Well, you know, having lived off and on in La Cañada for over 55 years, I can tell you that as a kid, when you used to see guys, grown men, riding a bicycle, it was usually a guy with a pocket protector who was on his way to JPL, was riding over to JPL. You don't see that anymore.
Interestingly enough, I remember, not in our neighborhood, but sort of Altadena, Pasadena, maybe even beyond. I'm trying to think of the place that meant City of Homes. I can't remember the hell that is. It's
City of Homes.
It's just
not Duarte.
It's past Duarte.
Oh, Bradbury?
Arcadia.
Okay. Thank you.
You should have said City of Large Asian or Large Homes Occupied by Asians.
I seem to recall that a Agajarian or one of the big promoters, one of the big like either concert or off-road promoters was executed.
Correct.
Like in his driveway by a guy on a bicycle.
On a bicycle, absolutely.
Which,
in fact, Alan Jackson, I think, tried that case. And it was tried in Pasadena years later, and he and his wife, the promoter, what was it, Mickey? Was it
Mickey Thompson?
Mickey Thompson, yeah, executed by a guy identified by witnesses as seemingly an African American on a bicycle in that neighborhood.
Right. In that same neighborhood I'm talking about, like Arcadia or Pasadena or something.
I want to say it was Bradbury, and I'll bet you Gary's going to look it up. Bradbury is this wealthy enclave, very small place, total equestrian community because it's very close to the track, and a lot of people have only horses, but they've got riding rings.
Santa Anita is right there.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right. So the one side of the freeway is Arcadia. The other side is Bradbury, whatever it is. But the point is this. We were talking a few episodes ago about if you're murdered, it's somebody you know.
You're right.
And if you're, you know, 50, 60-something-year-old guy, and you and your wife are just gunned down in your own driveway by a brother on a Schwinn, that's a business partner situation
Didn't the guy who got convicted, Gary, he was in Judge Schwartz's court in Pasadena. I remember this case because I was in trial next door.
Bradbury, the most expensive zip code in America.
Yeah.
Circa 2010.
It's fallen off the list, but it's still definitely up there.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember back in the day, before the 2008 credit crisis, there were homes there going for astronomical prices because literally you could have your racehorses there, the trainers and people would live there, and they could literally have enough acreage to have a mini track and put the horses out on the track.
Yeah, I'm reading here that there's a gated community where it's called Bradbury Estates, and every lot is a minimum of 5 acres.
Yeah.
Wow. Was it Mickey Thompson who was executed? I know he and his wife, right?
Why am I thinking Trudy?
We'll work that out, and then tell us what happened with the case.
Trudy was in fact the name of one of his spouses.
That's why you're good. Mm-hmm. All right, Gary, did you find anything about the promoter?
Sure did. I'm sorry. We're talking about the Mickey Thompson murder?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So two assailants waited outside their home, and when they came out for the day, they went up and they shot him and wounded him, went into the garage where his wife was, shot her in the head, murdered her, then came back down the driveway to where one of the assailants was standing over the wounded Thompson and put a bullet in his head. That was in 1988, and there was not really any movement in the case until 2001 when they tried to charge former business partner Michael Frank Goodwin. That was then overturned based on jurisdiction or something.
Right. That was Orange County DA. I think it was Rukakis at the time brought the case in Orange County. They said there's no connection. dismissed for no jurisdiction, and then they lateraled it to L.A.
Right. I remember him calling it ridiculous that you would even bring this to my attention.
Yeah, so in 2000...
I wanted to replace ridiculous with ridiculous many years ago.
2004, it was brought to charges in Pasadena, and in 2006, a Superior Court judge finally ordered him to stand trial. In January 2007, he was found guilty of two counts of murder, sentenced to two consecutive life sentences.
The partner was, but what about the trigger man or the two trigger
men? The two trigger men have not been located.
Never been located.
I got to say, in my world, I've brought it up before, the guy, like the Ray Carruth thing, the Ray Carruth thing's going on. Gary, more homework, but Ray Carruth is due to get out of the slammer any day now, I think. The scariest individual to me is not the business partner that might have legitimate gripes. Like, you know, I don't know Mickey Thompson. Mickey Thompson was a guy who started promoting all these outdoor stadiums.
Yeah, he'd do the Coliseum, and he would do
the motorcycle races, the monster truck, the right. dune buggies and all that stuff. He even had his own brand of off-road tires, Mickey Thompson tires. Used to sell all that for dragsters and everything
what was,
else.
What was the name of that? What was the name of the... They used to be huge
probably
when we were growing up.
Twisters or yeah, something exactly. like that. But Mickey Thompson was a big brand. Now, Mickey Thompson obviously had some sort of disagreement with his business partner. And for all I know, Mickey was fucking over his business partner. Like, I don't know if he's an innocent victim and his business partner is just cruel and greedy, or if Mickey was actually screwing somebody over and his business partner decided this is the only way to deal with it. But either way, his business partner is not the scariest guy on the planet.
No.
The two brothers on the Schwinns, who the business partner gave, I guarantee, less than $5,000 gave him an address and a picture of the wife and the husband and said, just ride up on the Schwinn and go ahead and put a cap in everyone's skull and then ride back and I'll have someone else pick you up in a car.
And it's
those are the scariest. Those two guys were never caught. Right? And those are the scariest guys on the planet because for $3,500, they will kill anybody at any time.
That's absolutely true. Have I told you this story before? I remember.
I want to know, tell me the story, but I want to know where you come down. That wouldn't be a death penalty type charge, but for me...
Well, it's clearly special circumstances. What do you get, Gary? Two consecutive lives or life without parole?
Not him.
Two consecutive lives.
The yeah. trigger guys.
Oh, the trigger guys.
It wouldn't
guys.
Be death penalty no, for
you
them.
Know. You know
but
what
I
you
want
sorry,
it to be death
two consecutive
penalty.
Life without parole.
Without paroles. That's why I say because it's a special circumstance because obviously it was for financial gain. Well, I presumably would be the special circumstance which triggers either life without, which we call LWOP, or the death penalty. But prosecutors generally,
quick,
when they
quick
find,
go back, the because financial gain versus crime of passion or
correct.
Something like
if
that.
If you did a murder because you were... irate, or you were angry, or the old Texas example where you find your wife in bed with your neighbor, or something like that. That's classic heat of passion, which negates malice, which means you need malice in order to have murder. Murder is basically the unlawful killing of another with malice aforethought. If you've got the unlawful killing of another, that's manslaughter, and then it can either be voluntary or involuntary. But generally, as a practical matter, I'm with you, and I've never understood this, but the law has evolved, or prosecutors have evolved, where the trigger man generally rolls on the guy who hired him, and the trigger man gets the benefit of the deal, and the guy who hired him, or the woman who hired him, gets the full brunt and force of the law. In fact, I read an article this morning, somewhere, I want to say, here in California, where... So I think it's in Kern County, which is Bakersfield probably, where some guy who's a fireman meets a woman who's given away food at Costco. They're both married. They start having a torrid love affair. The woman at Costco is married to some guy who's a swinger. Next thing you know, the fireman ends up murdering the husband, the swinger husband. And wife is, I think, now on trial because trigger man gets a deal for 25 years in a manslaughter, but they want to get the wife for murder.
Gary's holding a thumbs up, so that means yes. So
you got that.
So in my world, the guys who have no dog in the fight and are simply will simply wander around, and whoever gives them $4,000, they'll happily execute.
Right.
And by the way, if the wife or the daughter or the mailman happens to be hanging out, we'll happily execute them as well for the price of a very used mini pickup truck from the 80s.
Right. A Toyota Highlander 1998.
Right.
Yeah.
Easily do that. That person is a scary person in terms of a person that can float around society.
Yeah, because that guy doesn't care, or that woman doesn't care. They don't give a shit. $3,500, I'll snuff you.
And that person has never been caught.
Neither one. I had forgotten, Gary, that there were two in the Mickey Thompson case.
Yeah, and on a bicycle.
Well, I remember the bicycle.
I do remember that, too.
Because there's a
It wasn't a tandem bike. There were two.
No, yeah. There are two bikes.
Yeah, because two African-Americans riding a bike on a tandem in Arcadia would attract attention. But two guys on a 10-speed?
No,
they could have just been lost from Duarte.
That's right. All right, let me tell you about Vault on History. Stream the largest offering of classic series, documentaries, and...
Or documentaries.
Documentaries. Cutting edge. I have a disorder.
I did that last night. I caught myself doing it, but I was probably at a point. I was only at a 0.06, and I did it like three times in a row. And it was like, you know what it reminded me of, though?
Hmm.
I was talking with Mia St. John, who's a client of mine when I
boxer.
Was in New York. Boxer, yeah. And Mia was saying, she's a avid listener to the show, and she was saying how spot on you and I were talking about how as you get older as a boxer, you're not as quick. And she says it's like you can see the punches coming, your brain knows what to do, but your brain can't get your body to do it. And it was the same way with me yesterday, just trying to articulate something, and I just couldn't do it. Boom.
Punch Drunk Law
Punch
with
drunk
Mark
law.
Gargas.
Exactly.
No commercials, no videos added. Oh, I should say new videos. See, there I go. New videos added every week. Back to Vault on History. The series like America, The Story of Us, and Modern Marvels, one of my favorites. I think I've seen all of them. Hundreds of hours of videos exploring ancient Rome, U.S. presidents, military history. Watch anytime, anywhere from your favorite device. Our listeners get an exclusive extended 1 month free trial. Go to historyvault.com/reasonable doubt. That's historyvault.com/reasonable doubt. Okay, so Paul Butler, I believe, is going to be on the phone any moment now. Chokehold, Policing Black Men, available on Amazon. It's a new book. He's a law professor. This guy has some pretty good credentials. Yale,
Georgetown,
Harvard
right?
Law.
Yeah.
Yale and Harvard Law, so it says here. Federal line two. He's a federal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice.
Federal prosecutor, not even former. Former federal prosecutor.
We've probably been in the same courtroom a couple of times.
You two have crossed paths in some Article III district courts.
And he is a professor at Georgetown University. He is Paul Butler. Paul, good to speak to you.
Hey, guys. It's great to be here.
Paul, Mark and I speak quite often about the overreach of law and the whole system and, you know, from the cops on the street all the way up through the courthouse and what we can do about it. But tell us your perspective.
So in my new book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men, Renegade Prosecutors, Radical Thoughts About How We Can Transform American Criminal Justice. Transform is the key word. The system is way too messed up to talk about reform. I'm seeing, as a prosecutor, my work was to lock up black men and Hispanic men and poor people. As a prosecutor, that's pretty much all I did. And so when we think about other kinds of control, racial control, we didn't talk about reforming slavery. We talked about abolishing it. We didn't talk about reforming the old Jim Crow. We talked about abolishing it. And I think it's time now to imagine abolishing the new Jim Crow.
So I've got a question.
Yeah, you're saying, which is not reform, but transform.
Right. It's why one of the reasons, if you do criminal justice for any period of time, you become an anarchist, because there's no way to exist in the system. I mean, you become window dressing. The criminal defense lawyer is window dressing. And I assume Paul would agree with me. Prosecutors wield all the power in the system.
Way more power than judges.
That's
when
for
I was
sure.
a prosecutor, I ran the show. You know, defense attorney would come to me and I say, tell you what, we're going to make a little bit of a deal here. If your client accepts this offer today, then you'll just do 2 years. You make me go through the trouble of going to trial, we're looking at 10 years, and I'm going to win. And half the time I was bluffing. You know, the defendant doesn't know what the evidence is, and because the rules for discovery, which is how the other side finds out what the government's evidence, in criminal cases, they're so limited that sometimes the accused person doesn't know what the government's case is until shortly before trial. So how can you make an informed decision about whether to go to trial? The result is that 95% of people who are accused of crimes plead guilty. Not necessarily because they are guilty or they think they're going to lose their trial, but because the government, that is the prosecutor, says if you go to trial and you lose, I'm going to throw the book at you. And that's what prosecutors do.
Paul, where were you a prosecutor?
I was working at Maine Justice in D.C., so I was doing public corruption cases all over the country, but the formulative experience was what the Department of Justice does for guys like me. I was kind of this egghead who'd gone to Harvard Law School and then worked for a fancy law firm where I got no trial experience. Mark knows about this.
Right. And then, so, Paul, did they put you into the D.C., what I always call the D.C. Superior Court?
That's exactly where I was sent, Mark, because they wanted me to get trial experience. And so it's kind of like training on the people, the poor jurors of the District of Columbia.
Yeah.
And that's really what opened my eyes to just, you know, kind of the casual brutality of the system. I was doing misdemeanor crimes, but it was to get training. I remember my boss literally said to us, you know, don't worry if you win or lose. You should just try out different kind of styles of litigation, see what works for you in terms of being a prosecutor. They said if they're that bad, if the defendant is that bad, he'll be back.
Hey, you know what they used to say about that, Paul? They used to say, some shall burn so you can learn. And and I used to just say, there's something just totally Alice in Wonderland looking through the looking glass. I spent a lot of time with a very well-to-do defendant client in that courthouse 2 years ago, and I was shocked. It's very reminiscent, to me at least, of what the criminal courts building was back in the late 80s during the crack epidemic as to what's going on in that courthouse now.
If you go to Superior Court in D.C., you would think that white people don't commit crimes.
Right.
people are about 50% of the citizens of the District of Columbia. They're not present in the criminal court as accused people, so you would think that white people don't use drugs, they don't get into fights, they don't steal, but black people, brown people, man, those are some bad dudes, because that's all you see
Paul,
the criminal court in D.C.
So I have a question for you, because there's some nuance, which is, you know, you said black people, brown people, and poor people. I'm sort of the mind of poor people, and poor people who get jobbed by the system, and they're more poor black and brown people than there are white, Asian, whomever. But how much of this is poor, poor, and poor versus just out-and-out racism?
That's a great question, Adam. And I want to say that if you are a poor person in our criminal justice system, if you don't have a great lawyer, you are screwed. I would rather be a guilty person with a great lawyer than an innocent poor person with a lousy lawyer.
That is
because
the
way
that
our system is set up, it's just if you don't have someone who's looking out for your interests, even then, you're likely to get screwed. Sometimes I have the privilege of representing people on appeal. I love to do trials, but I can't with my schedule as a teacher. So sometimes people, every now and then, I'll accept an appeal. First thing I say to the client, we're going to lose. I'm a great lawyer, but just looking at the statistics for appeals, 90%, I'm going to do my best, we're going to lose. So anybody who's accused of a crime is in bad shape. You know, I wrote an article about the Gideon case a couple years ago. That's the famous case in which the Supreme Court said that if you're poor and you can't afford a lawyer, then the government will pay for a lawyer for you. Well, guess what? If you're a black man who's charged with a crime, you would be better off going to trial in 1960 without a lawyer than you would be in 2017 with a lawyer. You're more likely to go to jail now than you were back in the day, even without a lawyer.
That's so true.
That just shows you how the system is stacked against.
I
do want to say there's something sticky about race. So, again, any poor person, the odds are against him or her. But, you know, kind of my cover-up experience that I talk about in my first book, Let's Get Free, I was not a poor person. I had the most high-profile case in the United States Department of Justice. I was prosecuting a United States senator for public corruption. During the time that I was working that case, I got arrested and prosecuted for a crime I didn't commit. And I want everybody to buy the book, so I'm not going to say how things came out, but I'll give you a hint. Things worked out really well for me.
What'd you get arrested for?
I think I know. Were you on a bicycle in Arcadia?
Oh.
It's a throwback to the earlier part of the show.
Wait, Paul, I have a vague memory of this, but I don't want to accuse you of something because you were already once falsely accused. What was the arrest for?
Crazy little misdemeanor about the neighborhood dispute, Fred and Barney dispute about a parking space. You know, it's funny, at the trial, the judge said to the jury, this is a dispute about a parking space between two people. Neither of them drives a car.
I told you it was on a bike.
You knew it was on a bicycle. This Adam, it's probably the League of Former Federal Prosecutors.
We're pretty tight. We have a mind meld. So, Paul, what would you like? Okay, so I have this thing. So first off, I kind of liken this to healthcare, where, you know, we make a proclamation that everyone who lives in this country should have world-class healthcare, affordable and available to them, but we all know if you have money, you can get the good stuff.
Right, you can get concierge medicine.
And if you don't, you're kind of throwing yourself on the mercy of the court, pardon the pun. And the health care and the law is the same. Like, we make this a proclamation that everybody deserves equal justice in the eyes of, and everyone deserves world-class health care, and you got money, it's much better on both accords. But for you, my problem with stuff is I stand back and I look at stuff and I just think, this is inherently flawed because you're telling these people you have an unlimited budget, you have unlimited power, and you can just go ahead and do whatever you want, and there's really no checks and balances. So it's going to go down this path, no matter what, especially when you ask people to do the right thing, but nobody's watching and nobody's governing over you, then you don't do the right thing. And we've heard a million cases of it. So how would you blow up the system, or forget about how would you do it? What would you put in its place?
I'd abolish prisons. I know it sounds crazy. Let me tell you why it's not. Well, what is it that we think prison does? We hope that it keeps us safe from people who would cause us harm, and we hope that it makes people accountable when they've caused harm. I'll bet Mark knows prison doesn't do either one of those very well.
It doesn't do it even remotely well.
Exactly. And there actually are communities that are experimenting with all kinds of ways to achieve those purposes that don't involve locking people in a cage like an animal. So in Brooklyn, there's this program, Common Justice, where if you harm somebody and you're arrested, if the victim consents, you're taken out of this criminal justice system. It's not diversion, totally outside the system. A restorative justice where you have to meet with the person who you hurt, and you have to work it out with him or her, and you have to work out your own issues. It takes 2 years. Sometimes dudes in the middle of this, they say, man, I wish I'd gone to jail because this is too hard. But guess what? It works way better, way lower recidivist rate than locking people up. You know, the other thing about it is sometimes people say, well, what about the 5%? Except they don't know it's 5%. So when we ask, what are people locked up for in prison? Only 5% are for murder and rape and child sex abuse. So we think of those as the worst crimes. I don't know what to do with that 5% right now. But I'll tell you what, the 95% who didn't commit the worst crimes, again, I think we ought to start thinking about ways to address that. Again, without locking them up in a cage like an animal.
Did you see the 60 Minutes piece out of Germany, I believe it was, about a year ago or so?
I did not.
They had a whole piece. Gary watches the show. I watch the show. It was about a year or so ago where they had the prisoners, and I believe it was in Germany. And these guys got out. They met with their families. They went, you know, they sort of, it was kind of Otis from Mayberry, where they'd come back at the end of the day and lock themselves back up again. But during the day, they could go to work and be with the community and be with the family. Was it out of Germany?
It is Germany.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story about how this works. Now, some horrible politician would say, well, that's a completely different environment over there, and we can't do the apples to apples. But whatever
he's taking massive contributions from the correctional officers.
The thing
union.
That stood out to me that exactly. I liked was
exactly.
Yeah, Gary.
They were interviewing like the warden, and he said, you know, when these guys get out, they could be my neighbor. So why right. wouldn't we help reform them? They are coming back into society.
Well, the easiest thing to do as a politician is announce you're tough on crime.
Right.
And so when you start talking about abolishing prisons, that's hard to get elected on that platform. So how do we then remove this from that equation? So we're never going to get a politician to go, I'd like to abolish prisons, because they won't get elected. So we can't give them that power. We must somehow circumvent that somehow, or get to a place where this can be done without politicians, because politicians will never consent to this.
The politicians won't, number one. And number two, most of these prisons, the great majority of prisoners in America are in state or local facilities. So you've got to, those are funded by state taxes, presumably, or local taxes, which once more gets you right into the conundrum of what do? You got to drive through the politicians.
Right. So how do we get through these?
Right. So in Chokehold, I say, let's not think about abolition as opening up every door tomorrow. Let's instead look at gradual decarceration. So there's some easy targets. 10% of the people who are locked up now are over 55. Those are not bad dudes who, if they're out, they're going to be menaces to society. In most cases, they've been locked up for so long. They're way out of their crime committing years, and they've paid their debt to society. But check this out. Now prisons are literally operating assisted living facilities
exactly.
for some of these old dudes. I mean, that's ridiculous. So 10% right there. 80% of people who are in prison are either addicts or suffering from mental illness. Prisons are now, I would say, the largest mental health service providers, except they don't actually provide services, most of them. All they do is house people who are mentally ill. So we start looking at ways of getting those folks the health care that they need. And the other thing I think about is decriminalizing a lot of these misdemeanors that people get locked up for now. And that's happening right now. So, you know, a lot of cities that have seen the ravages of the new Jim Crow, seen families and communities torn apart, not by crime, but by punishment, they're getting it. So we're actually seeing this wave of progressive prosecutors who are elected, who are saying, my job is to lock up fewer people. So Cyrus Vance in New York City, Manhattan, he says, we don't need to arrest people for jumping the turnstile. In Brooklyn, the prosecutor said, we don't need to arrest people for smoking a blunt on the street. There are other ways of dealing with this. So we start thinking about decriminalizing misdemeanors, because 80% of people who are get arrested, it's not felonies, it's not major crime. It's things like jaywalking, jumping the turnstile, getting into a fight with their boy. We don't need to lock up folks for that.
No, I agree. And, you know, I think, you know, to be honest about the problem and the situation, it's a two-way. I think there's a sort of two-prong attack to this. One is the system. The other is what's going on the home front as well. There's a lot of kids without a lot of dads that have a lot of time on the street that are the ones that are getting caught up in this system. So I think there needs to be a focus on that, too, which is not providing a new crop to get caught into the system, even if the system is unjust.
Well, you know, my father, who was a prosecutor for many years, and Adam's heard this, Paul, but he used to say, you want to solve the crime problem, just arrest all males between the ages of 16 and 24. Crime will disappear immediately. There is a certain demographic that disproportionately commits crime. And bullshit crime, because, you know, as Paul has mentioned, the quality of life offenses, you know, Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes or things like that. I mean, what a six cops to take him down because he's selling cigarettes and not paying the tobacco fees. I mean, it's a joke.
Agreed.
That's crazy. Yeah. And this is where I look at history. So, you know, the way that a lot of people look at African-Americans now is kind of having this big criminal element. If we were having this conversation 100 years ago, we'd be talking about the same thing, except we wouldn't be saying black. We'd be talking about Italians, Irish, and Jews. Those were the folks who, the groups that people thought were especially prone to crime in the early 1900s. And what happened? One thing that happened was the New Deal. The idea that if people got this massive influx of resources, of support from the government, that they might find other ways to take care of themselves. So we got the GI Bill, we got Social Security, we got the beginnings of some kinds of health care. The interesting thing is black people were excluded from those, in part because of the kind of work that black folks were doing, work on farms, work in people's homes. Those were explicitly excluded from a lot of the New Deal programs. So President Obama said, what we need is that kind of, we don't have to call it reparations. We can think of it as a Marshall Plan for the inner city. So to your point, Adam, resources, looking at ways to give people opportunities and hope. Now we get those resources. We in the black community get them, but we get them in the form of policing and incarceration.
The book is called Chokehold, Policing Black Men. It's available on Amazon. You can go through our website, bookmark us, and spread a little love our direction as well. Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown, has
Paul,
been our
how
guest.
Many years you've been at Georgetown?
This is my fifth year at Georgetown. I actually have the honor of being a visiting professor at Harvard Law School this year, so I'm talking to you from my fancy office in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Wow. Well, Paul, when you get out to L.A., come see us in person.
Absolutely.
And we'll continue the discussion.
We'll love to. I've heard all about your studio, so I can't wait to see that.
Not as nice as your Harvard office, but any port in a storm. Thank you, Paul.
You bet, fellas. Thanks for having
Bye,
me.
Take care of yourself. Yeah, the thing, you know, it's always a little touchy because I am sort of on both sides, which is supply and demand. Like, my feeling is sort of like when it comes to the drug problem.
Right.
You know, some people go, oh, we got all this stuff coming in from Mexico. We got to beef up the border. And then the next guy goes, well, look, we didn't have all the rich white kids in Orange County sucking up all the, coke, then they wouldn't have to come
exactly.
over. And my thing is like, all right. Here's the guy. I don't work on the border, and I don't do that much coke.
Right. Except when you're with hookers, but that's to be
expected.
Yeah,
but that's – listen, first off, Lynette, she understood going in. When you're, you know, when you're hooking up with a comedian, whether it's
right.
me or Artie Lang, there's
right.
just certain
– there's certain things that are expected.
They come with the territory.
Right. All hookers,
right.
strippers, coke.
Many,
hold
but
on.
Many
Before
perks.
You get to that, let me yeah. just mention one thing. Did you know that time is money?
Yes.
Okay. Especially when you run a business. Don't waste your time on legal needs. I'm here to tell you, as a lawyer who employs lawyers, has law firms and offices throughout the United States, use LegalZoom.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
LegalZoom. 2 million people have used it. They start their business. I've used it. There's times when I say to myself, am I going to waste some associate's time doing some ministerial task? Why not use LegalZoom? They don't, you know, they help you start their business, and their services don't even end there. They running a business comes with taxes. We know that. Contracts, hiring employees, a lot of fine print. LegalZoom provides the advice you need to get through your daily grind, and it is some days a grind. It isn't a law firm. They work with independent lawyers, now licensed in all 50 states, who are focused on helping you and not logging billable hours. Isn't that right, Gary?
That is right. Set up your estate plan at LegalZoom.com now. And for special savings, enter doubt at checkout. LegalZoom.com, enter doubt.
So back to the analogy.
Before I so rudely interrupted you.
That's okay. The border. So yeah. I'm the guy who doesn't have a dog in a fight, but I say, look, how about we do this? Instead of blaming the border control or blaming the consumer, how about we simultaneously work on beefing up the border while we work on rehab and education.
Reducing demand
while we do this. And whenever I speak to folks like Paul Butler, I say, yes, the cops are out of line. On the other hand, there's a lot of teenage black guys standing around with nowhere to go, no dad, no books to study, no anything. And let's work on that simultaneously.
Yeah, I've never understood why it has to be either or. I don't get that at all.
It's both. It's both. Here's the deal. Straighten out, work on the system, work on the cops, work on all the ills of the system while simultaneously not providing them with as many folks as they can railroad.
Right.
With the cutback on the population of folks that they can do wrong in a system that's broken, while simultaneously fixing the system and working on the number of folks that could potentially get sucked into the system.
It's so true, and part of the problem is because it's not run like a business. If it were run like a business, that's what you would do. And when you're running a business, just because you got increased revenues, does that mean you don't look at what your expenses are? Of course, you look at both. So here you want to do the same thing. I want to know why this problem is occurring. I want to try to minimize the occurrence of the problem, and at the same time, I want to solve the problem. So,
right.
Nobody's going to run it like a business.
It comes down to politics, where a group on one side wants to talk about the system, the group on the other side wants to talk about the breakdown of the family and turn it into a sort of moral argument.
Right.
And my thing is I think they both make some pretty valid points, so why don't we just cherry pick their best
points, and
we'll meet in the middle.
Yeah, you're not going to get a dispute on any of this from me.
Those days are in our rearview mirror, sadly. All right, not Taco Bell material. That's me. That is coming up a week from today, right? Saturday the 23rd. That'll be in, no?
That's tonight.
All right, so that'll be tonight, Chicago Park West. Maybe a couple of tickets left for that, so come check that out. And then Friday the 13th, October 13th, that's Minneapolis Music Hall. And then Saturday, October 14th, Nashville Polk Theater. You go to amcroll.com. We have live podcasts or stand-up shows. You can go to Chassis and check out Two S's and a Y on Chassis, C-H-A-S-S-Y. And we got a lot of movies over there and Corolla Drinks. You say hi to Lynette and all the good stuff. Mark, what do you got?
We've got the audiobook narrated by our own Mike Dawson, Mistrial. We've got the Casa Tropicana in San Clemente. We got V Palm Springs. We got Tenney Restaurant downtown. In fact, if you go now, my son Jake is actually in the kitchen. You know, I'm reducing cost. I said, you know what? You haven't paid me rent, so get back there and start cooking.
He's banging a waitress, but he's in the kitchen, all right. So, until next time, Adam Carolla for Mark Garagus saying mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode. This is Corolla Digital.